Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Rex Heerman kept checklists for everything. According to prosecutors, he kept checklists on how to kill, how to clean, how to destroy evidence, how to keep the noise down while doing it. He allegedly maintained planning documents on his own computer, a literal blueprint for what he did, allegedly. Filed away like an architectural spec sheet. This is a man who, if prosecutors are to be believed, treated killing the way most people treat a home renovation. Methodical, sequential, organized to the point of obsession. And now, according to multiple sources familiar with the case, Rex Heerman is reportedly preparing to take the stand, or rather to stand in Suffolk County in a courtroom and plead guilty to murdering seven women. Think about that for a second. A man who allegedly spent decades building a system designed to avoid exactly this moment. Who used burner phones, who allegedly timed his crimes to when his family was out of town, who, according to investigators, searched online for information about the very investigation trying to find him, has apparently decided the best way to move left on the board is to say the words out loud, to admit it to every single charge. This is not a man who broke. This is a man who did the math. But I'm curious to get your thoughts in the comment section as we work through this and try to figure out and examine why now? Why now, Rex? Links are in the description. Substack, YouTube, weigh in. Heerman, the 62-year-old former Manhattan architect charged with seven counts of first-degree murder in the Gilgo Beach serial killings, is expected to change his plea at his next court appearance on April 8th. According to sources who spoke to the Associated Press, NBC News, and multiple other outlets, the victims' families and Heerman's own family have reportedly been notified. His defense attorney, Michael Brown, and Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney are reportedly negotiating the terms of a deal. The expected outcome is life in prison without the possibility of parole. Here's what makes this so striking. Just months ago, both sides said publicly there would be no plea deal after Judge Timothy Mazzei denied key defense motions in September of 25. D.A. Tierney told reporters there'd been no talk of a plea. Brown said the same. Entered a non-guilty plea. They were preparing for trial and a discussion. The trial was set for September 26, right after Labor Day. The prosecution had filed its statements of readiness. Everything was headed towards a courtroom showdown that would have been one of the most closely watched criminal trials of 2026, and really in New York history. So what changed? Everything and nothing. The sentence didn't change. Life without parole was always the ceiling. New York doesn't have the death penalty, so the maximum punishment Hiraman faces is the same whether he pleads guilty or gets convicted at trial. The number doesn't move, but the math around that number, what happens between now and that sentence, changed dramatically, and it changed because Rex Hiraman ran out of doors. Start with the DNA. This was the defense's primary strategy. Challenge the science, challenge the lab, challenge the admissibility of the evidence that tied Hiraman to six of his seven alleged victims. The prosecution's case relied heavily on whole genome sequencing, a cutting-edge forensic technique used by California-based Astera Forensics to extract nuclear DNA from rootless degraded hair samples found on or near the victims' bodies. Traditional forensic DNA testing companies compares about a dozen genetic markers. Whole genome sequencing examines tens of thousands of variations across the entire genome. It is powerful. It's relatively new in criminal court, and the defense wanted it gone. It's icky. It's yucky. It's witchcraft. I don't think they called it witchcraft, but they were very much like, yeah, you know, we this everything. They didn't like it because it's more accurate than what's been done in the past. It makes it more absolute of a verdict against Hiraman than anything in the past. So if you do what you do, if you're a defense attorney, you're going to go after that. This hasn't been used much, yeah, because it's new. And it's better than anything in the past. At some point, everything is new in a courtroom. At some point, fingerprints were new. This is just the latest. It's just far more identifiable. We could clone you out of the information we have. Not just identify you. The judge held months of hearings. The legal standard in New York for determining whether scientific evidence is admissible. They're called Fry hearings. Experts testified on both sides. And in September of 25, you may remember this, the judge issued a 27-page written ruling. The DNA stays in. They were fighting all last year to get that DNA out, get that new technology out. The science is sound. The evidence is admissible. The defense's first and most important challenge failed. So they're down one of their big things that they needed. So they tried again. Brown filed a second motion, this time arguing that Astera Forensics lacked a New York Department of Health permit required under public health law. That an out-of-state, non-permitted lab shouldn't be allowed to offer evidence in a New York criminal proceeding. The judge ruled on that one too. Denied. The court concluded that public health law restrictions don't apply to forensic laboratories used in criminal investigations and that the DNA was collected constitutionally with no violation of Hiraman's rights. Two swings at the DNA, two misses. The evidence linking Hiraman to the victims wasn't going anywhere. Then came severance. The defense pushed hard. They wanted the case split into as many as five separate trials. The argument had some surface logic to it. The killings allegedly spanned from 93 to 2010. The victims were found at different locations. The conditions of the remains varied. Brown argued that trying all the charges together would create an overwhelming cumulative effect that no jury could fairly parse. It's a fair argument. The judge, however, didn't buy it. The judge ruled that the cases were, in legal terms, inextricably interwoven, connected by geography, victimology, forensic patterns, and digital evidence, including those burner phones and internet searches. One trial, all seven victims, 3 decades of alleged killing compressed into a single proceeding. This Friday on ABC, TGIF is back. That ruling alone changed the calculus fundamentally. In a single trial, the prosecution doesn't just present the evidence for each victim in isolation. They weave it together. The planning document found on Huerman's computer, the one with the checklist, the one prosecutors described as a blueprint for how to commit murder and get away with it, doesn't just apply to one charge. It sits over all seven like a shadow. The pattern becomes the story. And for the defense, pattern is poison. The defense also moved to dismiss the murder charge related to Sandra Costella, whose remains were found in 1993, the earliest of the seven alleged killings. The argument was that the evidence tying Huerman to that specific murder was insufficient. That motion was still in play. But if the plea reportedly covers all seven charges, it suggests the defense assessed their chances on Costella the same way they assessed everything else. Not good enough. Add it all up. DNA admissible. Severance denied. The weakest charge still standing, a 723-page evidence inventory on the prosecution side, cell phone records placing Huerman in contact with victims before they vanished, internet search history that investigators described as documenting a fascination with violent content and an obsessive interest in the investigation into his own alleged crimes, and those burner phones, according to prosecutors, devices used to contact dozens of S workers kept physically near Huerman's personal phone, creating a digital trail that walked right up to his front door. When you look at it that way, the question isn't why Huerman is pleading guilty. The question is what a trial would have given him that a plea doesn't. Allergies, excuse me. The answer legally is nothing. The sentence is the same. Life without parole. That doesn't change with a jury verdict. But what does change enormously is what happens in the space between now and the sentence. A trial would have lasted months. Every piece of evidence the prosecution assembled over years of investigation would have been presented in open court, broadcast, analyzed, replayed, the search history, the content of those internet searches, the planning document, read line by line. The testimony about what was done to these women, the torture, the mutilation, the dismemberment that prosecutors have referenced in filings, all of it performed for the public record and a national audience. A guilty plea compresses that into a single proceeding. The evidence exists, it's in the record, but it doesn't get the months-long theatrical presentation that a trial demands. For a man who spent his entire alleged criminal career managing what people saw and knew about him, that distinction matters enormously. And then there's the family. Huerman's ex-wife, Asa Elrup, finalized their divorce. His daughter, Victoria, publicly stated that she believes her father is most likely responsible for these murders. That's an extraordinary thing. Your own child, on the record, saying she thinks you did it. A trial would have dragged them deeper into the spotlight, subpoenas, testimony, media coverage that would follow them for the rest of their lives, more than it already has been. A guilty plea doesn't erase their connection to the case, but it may limit the exposure. It may be the last thing Huerman can offer them. Not innocence, but at least the absence of a prolonged public spectacle. There may be deal terms that haven't been made public. Reporting indicates that Brown and Tierney are actively negotiating, but the parameters remain unclear. Plea agreements can address facility placement, conditions of confinement, specific charge structures. A negotiated plea gives the defense leverage to shape the terms of what comes next in ways that a post-trial conviction simply does not. Once a jury speaks, the defense has nothing left to trade. And there's one more piece that legal observers should watch closely. The appeal waiver. If Huerman has gone to trial or had gone to trial and been convicted, the whole genome sequencing ruling would have been a prime target on appeal. Novel science, first-time admission in a New York criminal case, a lab without a state permit, defense appellate attorneys would have circled that for years. Doesn't mean it would go anywhere, but they would have tried it. The guilty plea, by its nature, largely forecloses those challenges. Hearman waives the right to contest the DNA admissibility. He waives the right to challenge the severance ruling. He accepts the outcome. Why would that benefit a defendant? Because it ends the fight completely. No years of appellate proceedings. No hope dangled and withdrawn. No legal limbo. It's over. And depending on what the prosecution values, certainty of outcome, sparing families from a trial, closing the case permanently, that waiver may be part of what the defense is trading for whatever concessions are made on the table. But underneath the legal strategy, there is a psychological architecture to this decision that is impossible to ignore. Rex Hewerman, according to the prosecution's theory of this case, lived a double life for approximately 3 decades. Architect by day, husband, father, commuter on the Long Island Railroad. And then allegedly something else entirely when his family left town, a man who prosecutors say targeted vulnerable women specifically because he believed they wouldn't go to authorities, a man who kept his world separate with a precision that bordered on compulsive. Compartmentalization isn't just a word you attach to someone like this. According to prosecutors, it was allegedly the operating system. Burner phones kept in proximity to his real phone, but never crossing over. Crimes allegedly committed only during specific windows of family absence, planning documents stored on a personal computer in the home where his children slept. It's a lot of control. A guilty plea fits that pattern. It is, in its own way, the final act of compartmentalization and control. It is the last decision Hewerman gets to make on his own terms. He doesn't sit in a courtroom for months while prosecutors systematically dismantle the constructed identity he maintained for decades. He doesn't watch that identity unravel publicly, piece by piece, in front of cameras and a jury and the families of the women he allegedly murdered. He now decides when and how this ends. For a person who allegedly organized the most horrific acts imaginable into checklists and timetables, the timing of this is, well, it makes sense. The thing that may be most psychologically unbearable isn't prison. It's the loss of control. The loss of control that a trial represents. A trial's unpredictable. Rex was not. Witnesses say unexpected things. Evidence lands in ways you can't script. The narrative belongs to the prosecution. A plea hands at least some of that narrative control back. Then there's his health. Hewerman missed his March 17th court appearance due to undisclosed medical issues. His attorneys confirmed he'd been using crutches for over a month, but declined to elaborate. If there's an underlying medical condition and there's no public information confirming what it is, the psychological calculus shifts. A man who may be confronting his own mortality alongside a life sentence makes different decisions than a man planning a years-long or decades-long legal fight. If the plea does go through on April 8th, it will close the criminal case against Rex Hewerman without a trial. It will spare the families of Melissa Bartholomew, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Amber Lynn Costello, Sandra Costello, Valerie Mack, Jessica Taylor, and Megan Waterman from sitting through months of testimony about how their loved ones died. But it will not close the broader Gilgo Beach story, not even close. In December of 25, police arrested Andrew Dykes and charged him with the murder of Tanya Jackson, a woman known for years as Peaches, and her young daughter, Tatiana. For over a decade, investigators assumed they were victims of the Long Island serial killer. They weren't. Dykes was the child's father. His name was on the birth certificate. The same DNA genealogy technology that identified the victims led investigators directly to the man who allegedly killed them. Ocean Parkway was not one killer's dumping ground. It was a corridor used by multiple alleged predators. And some of those stories are still unfinished. As for Hewerman, if this plea is accepted, he will reportedly stand in a courtroom and admit to killing 7 women. Seven women who vanished between 93 and 2010. Seven women who were young, who were vulnerable, who were, according to prosecutors, targeted specifically because the man who allegedly killed them believed nobody would come looking. He will reportedly have to say their names. He will reportedly have to acknowledge out loud on the record what he did. For some families, that acknowledgement, forced, negotiated, strategic as it may be, is the closest thing to justice this case will ever produce. For others, no courtroom proceeding, no plea, no sentence will ever be enough. Both of those things are true at the same time. And that's the part of this story that no legal strategy, no blueprint, and no checklist can resolve. The architect spent his career designing structures meant to stand. His final design is the controlled demolition of his own defense. Built not to win, built to manage the wreckage on the way down. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. And we'll continue our conversation right there. Links are in the description. Press subscribe. Wherever you're listening, so you don't miss any of the cases we follow for you right here. We'll continue the conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
All right. Was it on your bingo card this year for Rex Huerman to plead guilty? Well, he hasn't officially done it yet, and the judge has to accept it. So we don't want to count the chickens before they hatch. But it looks like it might be happening in the next handful of days. We've been getting flooded with a lot of your messages and questions about this case. There's so many facets to it, because what we're really talking about is seven different murder cases, all combined into one. The life of Rex Huerman with his family, living this double life for all those years, that's a whole conversation unto itself. The lives of these victims, each and every single one of them and their families, that's at least seven more conversations. There's so many pieces to it. Today, we are going to break it down. We're going to answer some of your questions in the Q&A. So feel free to dump your questions there for us in YouTube, Substack, Facebook, wherever you're watching, and we'll try and get to them as we work our way through it. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. As always, my co-host, one of my best friends with us. Robin, was it on your bingo card that he was going to plea in this case?
No. Yeah. It was a shocking thing, and I do apologize for everyone tuning in if I glitch a little bit. I am on the road in the motorhome moving my son from one place to another, so we're on our Starlink today. But no, Tony, this was such a shock. Like one of those happy surprises, but sad at the same time, because I was really looking forward to having him weasel in front of us to try to get out of all this, because I know the evidence they had was overwhelming. But kind of like, you know, Koberger's thing was least, you know, getting ready, it was going, and then he pled guilty. But this, I feel like the public is being denied all his horrendousness. But the most important thing is the families are guaranteed some semblance of justice. So from that standpoint, yes. But so shocked? Yeah, totally shocked.
I am. I mean, last year we had the Koberger situation where he pled towards the 11th hour. We weren't quite to the 11th hour here with Rex, but we were getting close. Do you feel like this is taking anything away from the families, or is this the more swift path to justice? I'm trying to think of a way to frame it. What's your thoughts there?
You know, you don't know, because you just don't know what each family wants, needs, and would feel satisfied with, because that does vary a lot. And mm-hmm. Luckily, not having ever lost someone this horrendous way, I can't even suppose what it's like. But what we do have is we have a guarantee. We have guarantee he will be put away for the rest of his life. And for that, I'm grateful. For that, I'm glad there's no appeal. There's no chance. You know, we're not going to be hanging on our every word of the defense, you know, on a cross-examination, trying to defraud all these other people. So I'm grateful, but I just hope, as always, that the real victims in this, the ones that are survivors left behind, do find this satisfying and have some justice in it for them so they can move forward with whatever they want to do next.
I can agree. Yeah. I mean, if you think of it, I mean, if he were to fight this all the way to a verdict, there is a level of re-victimization that would go on in that trial through whatever defense that they would mount, basically refuting all the evidence that exists. And that in itself, I think that would be I've never been through it. Thank God. I can't imagine. So it's hard to contemplate. But to me, I think that would be the most enraging, is if the evidence, I mean, the hairs are there, his planning documents are there. I mean, his attorneys came to him, I'm sure, and said, there ain't really a way out of this, buddy. So this might make the most sense. But he could have kept going. There's nothing saying that he couldn't have kept going with this. But that, to me, I think would be the outside of the actual crime, the actual murders itself, is the injustice, the way that he could have gotten on the stand if he wanted to, or others could have gotten on the stand to back him up as witnesses or expert witnesses to try and vie for his innocence when all the evidence points elsewhere and he knows it's not true, and just to try and bamboozle people after they've already done something. That to me, I think that would be the hardest damn thing in the world. And I hope to God I am never in a situation like that, where I have a loved one that is deceased and somebody like this took them out, because I would not be a good person in that courtroom. I don't think I could peacefully sit there in the gallery and not get arrested. I think I, especially if it was like my kid or something, it would not be a good day. I would need a lot of good support folks with me going, it's not worth it, Tony. Calm down. Because that would be hard. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah. And, you know, the women that he wound up killing too, their families, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because you know they'd probably tried to discredit some of the people on the prosecution side, and I hate seeing that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they would actually do, though, because again, the evidence is so overwhelming. But at the same time, I don't know the victims' names that well, and I would like to know the victims' names better so people can really focus in and zero in on that. As well as, I really, God, it's a sensitive subject, because the women that he targeted, they were disenfranchised, I'll say, and they had their own issues and challenges throughout life, and it would have been really good, I think, from a maybe not from a family viewpoint, but from a public standpoint of realizing, hey, we need to do better as a society to protect women from having to, you know, I don't know what the case is here, but I know there's a lot of women that get trafficked against their will.
Yeah,
that might have been part of this as well, and he then targeted those types of women, which it's quadruple tragedy going on, because he thought he could actually take advantage of these women and hide in plain sight, and no one would ever notice. But gratefully, everyone notices when a loved one goes missing, and there's no explanation.
And I think this is one that kind of makes you think a little bit too about life, about the people that are in your life, the choices other people make in your life, people that you love and the choices they make. And if they're bad choices, if they're not good choices, if they're choices out of desperation, if they're choices because they were taken advantage of or trafficking, we're talking about people who were S workers. And in a lot of these cases, at the time of their death, their family really wasn't a present piece of their life. Some had like a sister, some had pieces here and there, but a lot of them were not necessarily going to Easter dinner or whatever. They were a bit estranged in many of these cases. And unfortunately, it took a tragedy like this, I think, for some families, I'm sure, to kind of reckon with the disconnect of however that happened with them and their loved one. And to really, I think, see the value sometimes that, that we overlook sometimes as human beings when we're upset at them because for whatever reason, this or that. And you always think there's going to be another day. There's going to be another day where hopefully this changes and she makes it right or he makes it, whatever it may, or things change and we can reconcile. You don't always get that opportunity. And and I think this is one of those cases where it really, it drives that point home. These families didn't have a chance to have that reconciliation moment with their daughters for however they chose or whatever their relationship status was. And unfortunately, they kind of have to do that very one-sided because they're gone. For those of us who do have families and loved ones, and not, I mean, obviously it's not common that everybody has family members that are doing this sort of work, but it doesn't matter what they're doing. It's just, it matters that they're human beings.
And they're victimized by a monster. And to value them,
yeah, and to value them for who they are while they are here. And the abandonment, the walking away. I mean, there's so many caveats to this, and it's all these complicated relationships. But unfortunately, I think a lot of those families had that realization too late. So if anything, it can be somewhat of a viewable lesson from the outside. Let's go to one of the questions that we got. It says, Tony, I watched both documentaries and cannot stop thinking about his daughter. She went and visited him in jail and came out still thinking he probably did it. This is Victoria, she says in the doc, I think he probably did it. While Asa on the other side is like, he's my hero. How do you sit across from someone and feel that? What do you think that daughter is going through right now? She already was kind of almost there he probably did it. Now we got essentially confirmation that it is him. How do you think the family is processing that?
Devastating. Absolutely devastating. Heartbreaking. Heart-wrenching. You know, and we saw this in the Duggar family as well, not serial killer side, but where you felt completely betrayed by someone who, for your entire life, you thought was there to protect you, to keep you safe, especially the father figures. They play a huge role in a young girl's life. They really do. And to have the protector, the provider of your life, who you thought you knew inside and out, to all of a sudden be this horrendous monster that kills women, and not just conjecture or what someone's accusing him of, admittingly doing that, it totally rips away your own self-identity, how you identify your family, your father, and this entire thing, and you're left with a huge gaping wound and hole of now what? And everything you thought you knew has completely been a lie, a huge, massive deception. And then who knows what she'll go through. But then I know there's a lot of self-blame in here. Should I have noticed something? Oh my God, I can't believe I didn't notice this. Could I have done something? So it's going to be a whole gamut of needed, and I know they already needed counseling before this, even more so now, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it seems Victoria was more dealing with reality on reality's terms than Asa. Asa, the mom, everyone was looking at her at the beginning. How did you not know this was going on? You went on vacation, and every time you went on vacation by yourself or with your kids, he didn't go, and then he was doing these horrible things. I mean, you got this lair in the basement, and we saw the way she kind of, you know, minimized it and explained it away in the documentary of like, I know what this room was once, and I wasn't allowed in here, but I, you know, she thinks she knows her husband, but her prism of who her husband is to her was not who he was to everybody else. And I think that's an interesting thing, because I think we see this on a much more micro level in many relationships where people have their secrets that they don't really, you know, atone to or talk about with their family. And it's not always, you know, I'm out killing sex workers. Sometimes it's, you know, like I'm addicted to gambling or whatever, you know, whatever it may be. That insert vice here of some sort. Usually it's something, you know, not like that, but something that they're going to keep hidden. Then to kind of square that up for Asa, who already, despite the damning evidence against her husband, he had the documents in his basement, basically the kill sheet. The hairs are there. It's all there. And she was still holding on to this hope that he wasn't this, because she was someone who came from a darker place, a place of insecurity. And he swooped in, we look at it differently. I mean, she looks at it as knight in shining armor. Mm-hmm. Everyone else probably looks at it as a predator finding prey, because he found in her someone who could be his partner, but also wouldn't ask too many questions. I think a lot of people, you know, relate to that to a certain extent. It doesn't mean everybody's out there being a killer, but people do look at this and go, what about me? We got a question here. Honestly, it says this case has messed with my head in a way I didn't expect. My husband travels for work. He's gone a lot. I know that's nothing, but I've caught myself thinking differently since I started following this case. Is that crazy? Or do you think a lot of people feel that way? That's from Lisa on Substack.
Yeah, people get paranoid sometimes when you follow things like this. But here's a fail-safe for everyone at every moment of every day. Just be transparent and seek transparency with those people you care about in your life. Be open, honest with your communication. Be transparent and be vulnerable. And as long as that's reciprocated back to you and at the same tempo, there's no wobbles in the force, there's no tempo shifts with anyone, and everyone's continuing to be that kind of person with you, then you don't have anything to worry about. Because remember, healthy relationships don't do this. But not all unhealthy relationships do. Because happy people just don't kill people. So yeah. If you have a good, happy relationship, it won't happen. Yeah.
Is there, let me throw this out there, because let's caveat this a little bit. Is there ever a world where a partner has a hidey space like this, where he was, I think it was like, what, under the stairs?
Right.
And it was his place where, I mean, there's like, I think we all have a secret place. And for a lot of us, it's our phone, you know, where like, although for a lot of people, it's not, where it's like, you know, I could care less, honestly. Me and my partner don't have each other's passwords, but if she ever wanted to, go ahead, take a look. I could care less. But, you know, for some people, that's very, very protected. I'm talking more than just a phone. I'm talking like a room, a space, a computer, things and places where you are not allowed to go to in that house. And you know, you can't. Is that, I mean, that to me would be a major red flag, no matter what's going on. Or,
huge.
You know, or some, but the thing is, some get conditioned in relationships to think, well, it's okay. We can have our own spaces and our own places. Like one person's using it to play, you know, Candy Crush. The other one is, you know, plotting how to kill, you know, S workers.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Yeah.
Do that happen all the time? Yes. Every single case I investigated inside the FBI, everyone had a secret place.
Yeah.
Whether it's this small or this large room, everyone had something. And what secret place is something from your perception that you're ashamed of, that you're afraid to share because you feel you're going to be judged in some way for that behavior you have, a vice you have, or something like that. I will say, though, the vast majority of human beings, when you share and are vulnerable, will get an immense amount of grace from the people who actually do care about you in your life. And so my counter to everything is, again, that open, honest communication. For example, just my wife and I, every time I go someplace, granted, I'm retired from the FBI. Most of the time I'm just traveling around, moving kids around, setting up weddings with my daughter and all this stuff. But I go to the gym every day and I do all these things. I'm out and about. I do backpacking. Every time my wife has any sort of question, my always response is, come with me. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you will, sometimes you won't. And so when you're always willing to have someone come along, always willing to engage, or same thing, like you said, open cell phones, all these things, as long as you're comfortable doing it, sharing everything with full transparency, and they're mm-hmm. willing to do that with you, good to go. What happens in the case like Heuermann, he groomed her into secrecy, accepting his secret place. And so it became a normal part of their relationship from a very, very young married couple age. And so when you mm-hmm. groom them into this, and then children are born, children is always accepted as what is, kind of like the Duggars. This is just the way it is. And so they're groomed into thinking it's acceptable for a grown man to have a secret room that is off limits to everyone, don't even know what's in there. And if you even whisper about it, things get angry. People get, I mean, when you have negative emotions and negative behaviors going behind secret things, that is not just a red flag. That is something serious shit going on. You got to really discuss and deal with, or get away from.
Yeah, I mean, and the normalization of it is interesting. And you don't know it's abnormal if you've never really experienced that before, or if you grew up around it. especially if you grew up around that type of behavior, that is normal to you. You know, if dad did this, if mom did this, if uncles, if somebody did it, like, oh, well, because we tend to take things that happen in our childhood, and if it happened in our childhood and we survived it, it's like, oh, that's okay. That's over there. That's, you know, and you don't really see the potential for darkness there either.
To just riff on that a little bit, yeah. Someone said gun safe. Yeah, definitely always lock up gun safes and things like that in the house for safety. You know, because here's a telltale sign to kind of riff with this. If someone is willing to have a secret place and keep it off limits, and that's the transparent secret place. In other words, you're aware that there's a secret place and you just know not to go in there. The likelihood of there being something else now that you're not aware of that's a secret is pretty damn high, because when people get comfortable keeping secrets from someone else in their life, that's a warning flag. If they're comfortable keeping secrets, there's a lot of secrets probably that they're being kept.
And after a certain point in time, I think of it kind of this way. Like if it's the first time you're hearing of it, and either you're going to accept that boundary, quote unquote, or you're not, you kind of got to speak up immediately, because if you don't, then the secret level just keeps rising and there's more things behind that veil, behind that secret. And even if you do suspect something, and I don't know if Asa suspected anything or not, I can't speak to that. I would be genuinely shocked if she didn't, not necessarily to this level, but just suspected that there was something amiss. Maybe Rex is a gambling problem. Maybe Rex has something over here. I'm going to guess she wouldn't have suspected it went to this level, but you don't necessarily want to pull that lever, I think, at a certain point either, because you also realize that pulling that lever, you don't know what's behind door number three, and it could completely blow up your own world too if you pull it. And right now, everything's working just swimmingly. We go on vacations separately, and it's okay. He's working. We got a home. We're, you know, I mean, to her, the norm, the status quo was just A-okay. And why ruffle those feathers? Because everything was going a hell of a lot better than what she had seen in her life, where she had come from too. So just not wanting to pull that lever, even if you do suspect something, it feels like that would go up over time too, just because of the sheer fear of what that could potentially mean by calling it out.
You hit it right there, Tony. Fear. It's the greatest motivator, yeah. And you're right. So again, let's reverse it. Let's put us in Asa's shoes. So you have all these red flags, or horrendous big red flags, right? But how's it impact her? Mm-hmm. He's still providing, making her feel safe. Safety, security, and prosperity, those are what we're seeking and craving. So even you've got red flags over here, which this is really incongruent behavior with what I would hope to have in a relationship. But again, if she's not doing a compare and contrast with anyone and anything, who knows? But if it's not impacting her in a negative way, why would she change it?
Yeah.
I mean, unless she's, again, she's suspecting something is going on that's not healthy, mm-hmm. but she can rationalize it away because it's not affecting me. He's a good provider. He's my knight in shining armor. I mean, see how she created that narrative of knight in shining armor, and that rode the arc through the entire thing. And all he had to do, the imagery that popped in my head, as you know, it always does with these things, is he's like Dracula and she's like Renfield.
Yeah.
You know, like he's out there sucking the life out of people, and there she is as the willing enabler, not asking too many questions, kind of cowering in the background, making sure that everything happens according to plan, but not really asking too many questions and trying not to be culpable even though I'm connected. Ech, that's it.
Well, and you also got to consider too, she's raising two kids. One has some disabilities, the other doesn't, but they were young, so that's two other worlds you got to blow up if you were to pull that lever. And then you have that guilt on top of it. You got fear, and then you have guilt too, because if you hadn't pulled that lever, none of this would have happened. And she never pulled the lever. Somebody else figured this out before she ever had to, so it was kind of forced upon her. But I think a lot of people live in that space, and it's a scary, scary place to be. And as time has gone on, I have a lot more empathy for her now that we've kind of seen this from a different, from a more balanced perspective. Because going in, it's like, come on, let's take a closer. But I think, I mean, if there was anything there, I think we would know it by now.
Yeah, they would have charged her. And I mean, but you know, they again, you get conditioned to learn how to turn a blind eye when you don't think it's like this. You know something unhealthy is going on, but to confront it, you are totally then negating all the choices you made in life. You're negating your own self-identity. Again, laws of human nature. It goes completely against what we think is in our best interest. Because remember, all of us, very predictable, we are going to act in what we as the individual thinks is our best interest in terms of our safety, security, and prosperity. He was doing all those things from her context, without a loving critic on the outside saying it, but from her context, that's what he was doing. Irrespective of the fact that she had, because she hasn't been charged, I agree, she had no idea that he's actually killing people and keeping trophies and doing other horrendous things. She just thought it was some gun safe he had down there, some boys club thing, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. And it all gets, and you play it down because you don't think that it can't be that bad. Surprise.
He's never
horrible, horrible situation. Unexpected development. We'll be doing a 5-part series on this soon, really breaking down all of the story, and helping folks better understand this whole case. And here's an interesting part to it too, before we move on to our next thing. He's essentially, if he does in fact plead to 7 of these murders, the 7 that he's charged with, there's a lot of unsolved ones still. Yeah. I would not be surprised if the thought process in confessing to these or admitting guilt on these somehow is connected to possibly other ones and maybe lowering the odds of being charged with those. I mean, it all depends how the system works as to if that were to come down or not.
And I'm also curious, Son of Sam law, I guess, is in effect in this case, so he cannot profit from this. I'm correct, because it is New York.
I do not know the answer to that, but
it's a good thing to look at, because here's the other thing I'm really curious about, because BTK did a similar thing where he pled, and then he's trickled out all these details over the years to keep the attention on himself. He was a lot more charismatic than Rex Huerman. And so I'm really curious. You know, part of the reason why is I researched this about what makes someone do this in this situation, you know, where he's being accused of being a serial killer. The only ones that are really fitting right now is overwhelming evidence. But again, if you're narcissistic and it's all about me, you want that kind of grandiosity. But some of the driving factors is family. So if the driving factor in this is because of his family's pressure and he's actually had enough empathy to succumb to it, I wonder what he's thinking he can actually do behind bars for the rest of their lives to help them maybe profit from it. Again, I'm really curious what he was thinking and what is in his mind about what he can do to provide for his family. Even it was like, all right, my life is ruined. Maybe I can still do something for them. I'm curious whether he has that kind of empathy to do.
I think that's a big question. What inspired him to go down this road of guilty? You know, what was that? That's something to think about. And we can discuss in the coming days on that. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Spring is sprung and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save.